I will admit it, I didn't really get what was going on. I started to see the news from a friend of mine who is a friend of mine from college who's this crazy left-wing blogger. And I saw one of his tweets that started talking about some sort of occupation. I didn't really understand what he was talking about, so I went to the embedded link. Then I read about this really strange and bizarre movement called Occupy Wall Street. And I didn't pay much heed because while he mentioned it, and it was like early or mid-October, I really hadn't heard anything about it in the newspapers or on regular news outlets. And then when I started to see things about it, it was usually from folks on the opposite end of his political spectrum. One after another speaker from the movement was put in front of a camera, and they just sounded ludicrous. They didn't talk about demands, but they seemed to babble about consensus and talk against greed and corporate life. But somewhere, I had to start paying attention because it started catching on and it started popping up all over the place. So even while they continued to be ridiculed by media figures, this Occupy movement grew, created new sites in other cities outside of New York City. And the group has difficulty working successfully. And successfully, if you define it as producing results and creating change. But it's not what seems what they're about. An ethicist, Gary Dorian, wrote an article for the Christian Century about this movement. And he spoke about the unconventional means of the organization, of the movement. It's not even an organization, the movement. He said, "For the occupiers, it's far more important to sustain a spirit of rebellion and to develop a radically democratic movement than to agree on what the government should do about derivatives or tax justice. Occupy Wall Street is not a progressive organization. It's not a social move. It is a social movement with a distinct ethos. The organizers understand that making government policy will never be their job anyway. Their job is to raise hell about a system that has turned American society into a pyramid and made a mockery of American democracy, and to build a social movement that practices radical, leaderless, direct democracy." In that same article, Dorian unleashes some stats that point out the inequalities that led to much of this outrage. How 1% of this nation holds 40% of its wealth, and brings in 25% of its annual income. The top 10% hold 70% of the wealth, and the bottom 50% only hold 2%. Staggering, just mind-blowing. And so with the attempts to make Occupy Wall Street look ludicrous, and the bits that The Daily Show and Stephen Colbert have done with the Occupy folk, it's all a bit reminiscent for me of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, as if we've been here all before. If you haven't seen it, it's King Arthur is out on his quest for the Holy Grail. He runs into a worker in the field, calls him old woman, and he says, "Man." He goes, "Oh, sorry, man." He says, "It's Dennis." "Okay." "He didn't even bother to know my name," he says. He refuses to be treated like an inferior. But Arthur points out, "Well, I am the king." He says, "How'd you get that, eh?" He says, "By exploiting the workers, by hanging on to outdated imperialistic dogma that perpetuates the economic and social differences in our society." It's a great scene. I left out the part about lobbing scimitars from a watery tart. But Arthur ends up riding away, because he just doesn't conceive of what Dennis is talking about. Kings are kings, serfs are serfs. Occupy Wall Street is fairly similar. It speaks about economic inequality, and to some, it gains almost no traction because they can't conceive of what is being talked about. The whole notion of our system is almost exclusively rooted now in that line from that old movie Wall Street, where Michael Douglas says, "Greed is good." We're taught to work and work and work and earn and earn and earn as much as we can. Being the 1% is the goal for many people. Less because of the money itself, and more because of the power that it buys. Power is key. Well, you know, when top executive pay in Europe started to reach, creep towards 20 times what the average worker in their company made, people there got upset and conversations started to happen. Nobody blinked in America in the 80s when executive pay was 40 times what the average worker was paid. And now that it is roughly 400 times what the average worker is paid, people are getting a little antsy. The notion seems to float around, though, that this is normal. It's only what the market demands. There's nothing wrong with making vast amounts of money. And this is a prevailing message that we're taught. But this, when I was reading through the text for this week, it really seems that the text from Jeremiah speaks to something entirely different. And so, pardon me, but I have to reach kind of beyond the appointed text because the lectionary committee went verses 11 through 16 and 20 through something. They cut it all up and the whole chapter hangs together in one long flow. So Ezekiel opens that 34th chapter with the word of the Lord against Israel's rulers. He speaks, "Thus says the Lord God, ah, shepherds of Israel who have been feeding yourselves, should not shepherds feed the sheep? You eat the fat, you clothe yourselves with the wool, you slaughter the fat ones, but you do not feed the sheep. The weak you have not strengthened, the sick you have not healed, the injured you have not bound up, the strayed you have not brought back, the lost you have not sought, and with force and harshness you have ruled them." The bigwigs in Israel are clearly not looking out for the best of all, but for the best for themselves. Now, I realize that much of the discussion of rich and poor here in Ezekiel, and they're dealing with, I've been dealing with issues of rich and poor and wealth and disparity and inequality, and I haven't really talked about rulers, but Ezekiel's dealing with rulers, so it might sound like there's a disconnect, but remember, the whole issue of money in the ultra-wealthy is the immense amount of power that they wield in our democratic system. And that is one of the things that the Occupy movement seems to be trying to bring to light, that notion that money is power. The Supreme Court ruled that campaign contributions are protected free speech. Today, to be rich is to wield power that most of us have no access to. And Ezekiel's opening of that 34th chapter is a really kind of a brief theological summary of politics. Those who wield political power have an opportunity to exercise righteousness. They can be part of ordering a community that is based on mutual love and support. But in the end, the shepherds that Ezekiel speaks to reject that opportunity and seek their own good. And the sheep are then subject to forces that treat them as prey, and the flock scatters. I want to be really clear here for a moment. The current system is broken. Invisible hands of the market always tend to work for the side that has the most money. But the Occupy Wall Street folks don't really have anything better. At least not ultimately. They can address inequalities. But Gary and Dorian pointed out in that same article that the roots of Occupy Wall Street are in the classic anarchist movements from the late 18th, early or late 19th, early 20th century. The underlying assumption in anarchy was that people are inherently good, and left to their own devices, they will work for the good. And we might really like to hope and believe that, but it's not true. People are not ultimately good. The anarchists overlook the power of sin in the world and the human tendency to turn inward and place him or herself in the place of God, become the center of the universe. And ultimately, there's no solution that's going to solve anything. No human solution will provide the ultimate and final equalization of humanity. And God knows this. God knows this because we heard that in God's words in the reading this morning. God declares, "And I will bring them out from the peoples and gather them from the countries and will bring them into their own land, and I will feed them on the mountain of Israel by the ravines and in all the inhabited places of the country. I will feed them with good pasture, and on the mountain heights of Israel shall be their grazing land. There they shall lie down in good grazing land, and on rich pasture they shall feed on the mountains of Israel. I myself will be the shepherd of my sheep, and I will make myself, and I myself will make them lie down," declares the Lord God. God provides the solution. God will be the solution. I myself will be the shepherd, God says. God will do what those who are in power, those humans who are in power, what they refuse to do. And God points out that this will happen when one shepherd, David, is set over them. That is today what we celebrate, that Jesus is set in that position, one belonging to both David and to God. He is the shepherd set above, the king, the prince, the head, over us all. And the leader here, Christ, that God sets over humanity as ruler or prince, is not just any old human. God is to set Jesus over us. And Jesus will be set over us in much the same way as he was set over us before. This passage, the passage that Jesus we have in the gospel today, where Jesus talks about the judgment of the nations, is the last teaching that Jesus gives us in Matthew before he enters his passion. Because right after this, he's arrested. Jesus is set over us, literally over us, on the cross, placing us and our needs before his own desires. Or what might be his own desires, because Christ shows a faithfulness to God's desire to rescue his flock from the ravages of sin. This is what it means for Christ to be set above us, what it means for God to be shepherd among us. We should hear Jesus' statement, "I am the good shepherd," ringing in our ears at the same time as we deal with this as Christ the King. The vision of the end, when we are judged and when God ends all brokenness and suffering, should in fact be a comfort for us precisely because of that. Because it points to the reality that it is Jesus who is Lord over us and not Caesar. We will not ultimately be controlled by economic and political systems that continually cater to those who have power and deal with harshness those who do not. Earthly rulers seek their own good. Jesus is the sovereign who does not seek his own good, but the good for the rest of us. And there it matters little if we're the 1% or the 99%. We are claimed through no merit of our own in the waters of baptism, where God promises something a lot like what we hear in Ezekiel. "The Lord shall be our God, and we shall be his people." Thanks be to God.